From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, I talk with our own Rebecca Hersher about the Ebola survivors she met in Liberia and how the government there is putting them to work. Also today, how a hallucination led to a great career in art.
I didn't know where I was going to go or what I was going to do, and this frog provided me with the answers to that.
That's hammered into right.
The invisible hands that bring you the sounds of the World Series.
The back crack is really kind of where everything starts for us.
And the flaming lips take on rock's most sacred cow.
That thing of it being like this untouchable thing, to us, it's like the better it is, the more you want to touch it.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. A mandatory quarantine. That's the new requirement in New York, New Jersey, and Illinois for people arriving from West Africa who have had direct contact with Ebola patients. This news comes as health workers in New York City care for the first person diagnosed with Ebola there. The patient's name is Craig Spencer, and he had been working with Doctors Without Borders in Guinea. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention this week announced new guidelines on the proper personal protective equipment that should be worn while treating Ebola patients like Spencer. The biggest change is that the CDC now says all skin should be covered. But in the heart of the outbreak in West Africa, NPR's Jason Beaubien reports there's wide variation in the protective gear being worn by people working with the infected.
Workers covered head to toe in hazmat suits have become an icon of this epidemic. Personal protective equipment is so ubiquitous that aid workers simply refer to it as PPE. In traffic in Monrovia, it's now possible to pull up next to a Land Cruiser and a body collector or an ambulance driver is decked out in a yellow jumpsuit, wraparound goggles, and latex gloves. But one set of PPE is often very different from another. Some versions cover every inch of the face with masks, hoods, and even plastic shields that look like welders' helmets. The World Health Organization is training Ebola workers with a simpler system that uses a gown, gloves, a partial hood, and just a surgical mask and goggles to cover the face.
The eyes, the nose, the mouth are well protected.
Dr. Srinivas Murthy is leading a WHO training session in Monrovia for workers who are about to be deployed to Ebola wards. Their faces are only partially covered by goggles and surgical masks.
The fact that there's maybe a glimmer of skin there is still reasonable given the risks going into a Ebola treatment unit.
There's a question about whether that glimmer of skin is a potential entry point for the virus. The CDC's new guidelines call for the workers' faces to be fully covered. Dr. Murthy says no set of gear offers 100% protection.
From our experience and from the WHO's expertise in terms of managing these wards, we are okay with that small glimmer of space, knowing the risks and benefits of covering it up.
One of the most dangerous moments on an Ebola ward is the undressing process. Murthy argues that with a simpler system, there's less chance of exposure to contaminated gear. And Murthy says training on Ebola safety is far more important than the hoods or the masks.
We don't want to teach them to wear 17 gloves and 14 hoods. We want to teach them to know why you're wearing what you're wearing and what the risks associated with Ebola transmission are.
And what to do in any given situation.
So that if you feel unsafe, then you leave. For example, if there's a huge spill, you get something in your face, on your goggles, those kinds of things. But that knowledge, I think, is more important than the equipment itself.
The WHO's PPE also happens to be cheaper than some other versions. Murthy acknowledges that this is not an insignificant issue, especially when you're looking to outfit thousands of healthcare workers across West Africa. Just a few miles away from the WHO training, workers at the Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, Ebola hospital, are putting on far heavier PPE that leaves no skin exposed.
PPE, the main suit, the yellow suit, is here. Usually we just get everything that we need and put it together over here and then get dressed over here. So
Dr. Dan Lucy, who runs one of the wards of this Ebola treatment unit, is a huge fan of the MSF version of PPE.
And they have very good gloves here. Everything is great. The MSF personal protective equipment is the best. And I can say that from having worked in Sierra Leone with other non-MSF work situations. you need that cover for the head.
Lucy is a professor of immunology at Georgetown. Last month, he was volunteering at a government-run hospital in Sierra Leone. Lucy shivers when he recalls the flimsy latex gloves he was expected to use there. He calls the MSF protective gear the gold standard.
Here we cover up the head. This is the special hood. So there's no exposed skin whatsoever.
MSF's equipment, however, does take longer to put on and take off than the WHO's protective gear. It's also heavier, including a thick rubber apron. The MSF suits get so hot and sweaty that workers are only able to stay on an Ebola ward for 45 minutes to an hour. The WHO gear is lighter and allows nurses and doctors to stay in the wards for up to 4 hours. There's still debate, however, about which is better. But with so many healthcare workers getting infected during this outbreak, more than 400 at last count, the trend is towards more protective gear rather than less. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
And our producer, Rebecca Hersher, was traveling with Jason Beaubien in Liberia 2 weeks ago. She's back now and with me in the studio. Becky, we just heard from Jason about the efforts to protect health workers adequately, but you also met with some health workers who don't need the heavy protective equipment to stay safe. Tell us about them.
Well, these are Ebola survivors, Arun. We met a lot of them. Double the number of people who have died of Ebola have gotten it, so there are a lot around, and they're a hot commodity. First of all, because they're immune to the disease now, and so they can work in clinics without all that heavy protective equipment. Also because the government holds them up as an example of surviving. It's hopeful. One of the major barriers in Liberia, in West Africa, to treating the disease is that people are afraid to go to hospitals. It's seen as a place where people die. And so holding up a survivor and saying, this person survived Ebola, that's a really powerful thing.
Is there any stigma with them, though? Any problems with the fact that they did have the disease? People might be afraid that they're still carriers.
Yeah, that's a really big problem. There's a lot of stigma. I met one woman whose parents, they had died of Ebola, and she was a survivor. And she had actually come back to the clinic where she had been treated, where her parents had died, to care for kids. And let's hear from her. Her name is Salome Karwa. She's 26 years old.
I help patients who are helpless. I bathe them. I feel the ones that are not able to eat and take care of the kids that their parents are positive.
She's talking about children, babies even, who come in with parents who are sick and who are confirmed to have Ebola. Now, these kids are at high risk for getting the disease. Some of them are not showing symptoms yet. And so the work she's doing is really important. It's also really stigmatized.
Becky, when you were in Liberia, the CDC announced new screening protocols for travelers coming to the U.S. from West Africa. What was your experience coming back to the U.S., and what precautions have you been taking since you've been back?
People are being given this piece of paper that says, hand this to your doctor if you get sick in the next 21 days. And this is a piece of paper that has all of the symptoms of Ebola on it, and it's meant to help doctors who are dealing with patients who are coming back from West Africa, from one of the countries that's been affected by Ebola. It has a hotline for the CDC. It has a list of things to watch for. And the first thing it says is isolate this patient. That, combined with taking your temperature daily, and that I've been doing that twice a day, is really the best defense, because this disease is not dangerous until you show symptoms. And so the most important thing is to screen for symptoms and watch yourself for symptoms. And that's what I'm doing.
All Things Considered's own Rebecca Hersher. Becky, great work. It's really nice to have you back, though.
Thanks.
The Kansas City Royals are up 2-1 on the San Francisco Giants in baseball's World Series. The teams meet again later tonight. Hard at work during each broadcast is Joe Carpenter, the in-house sound designer for Fox Sports. Carpenter and his team are the reason you can clearly hear sounds like the amped-up Kansas City crowd. Or the scuffle around a base as a runner steals second.
Runner goes. Throw down by Pierzynski. He's safe.
And, of course, the crack of a home run, like this one by the Giants' Gregor Blanco, to lead off Game 2 on Wednesday.
That's hammered into right.
The back crack is really kind of where everything starts for us. And to capture that sound, we use parabolic microphones, those big dishes that you see on the sideline of football games. Mm-hmm. We have three of those behind the plate, one on each side, a left and a right, kind of a stereo pair of those, and then one in the center to capture more of the umpire sound and maybe the pitcher.
On the outside corner. You can hear Osmer say it's down. It's a 1-1 count.
It's challenging in that every baseball stadium is different. So when we go into a place, you're presented with sometimes a completely different situation. But these three parabolic dishes that focus on the plate, sometimes with the right humidity and temperature, you will actually hear the ball traveling through the air. And you'll definitely hear the essence of the ball on the bat.
Strike one.
Roughly how many microphones do you have altogether? How many inputs do you have coming in?
I'd say altogether probably around 80 microphones.
Wow. And for directing that, for coordinating that during the show, I got to imagine that's incredibly complicated because, like you said, you're switching around 80 different inputs.
It sometimes becomes almost like you're playing a video game. My crew and I are also fans of the game of baseball, so it's kind of like we have a lot of fun chasing the sound around, you know what I mean? We're really following the video, so we're listening to the director calling, you know, you kind of get a preview of where they're going, and you're trying to chase the sound, but we're kind of just having fun. Occasionally, something will happen that maybe you don't see, but you'll hear it first, and then we'll kind of make the director take a shot of it because it's so prevalent. A good example would be like a guy's leading off a second base, and in baseball coverage, your primary angle for the start of every pitch is from behind the pitcher looking in at the catcher. So you might not necessarily see, you might see the top of the guy's head or the shortstop holding him on base. Sometimes the guy will go over and he'll be like smacking his glove a little bit and like, you know, trying to keep that guy to, you know, hold him on second base. And if we hear that through the microphone that we have in second base, maybe we'll open it up. Maybe that'll make the director tell camera four to widen out just a little bit more so that you can see the action where he'll cut to a shot from behind center so you see the guy holding him on.
One of the things I've noticed when I'm watching the games and I put it through my home stereo system is that you guys seem to have this set up for surround sound. When you're thinking about the home experience, how are you trying to set that up to create a kind of 3D acoustical experience?
Yeah, I'll tell you, that's kind of the biggest challenge for me is it's all about perspective. I'm trying to put you in the ballpark and create that same kind of atmosphere and excitement and sometimes subliminally divert your attention through the sound. Like maybe a good example of that would be a runner's leading off first base. You're looking at camera four's perspectives from center field, and we open up first base, Mike, and you might hear the first base coach talking to the runner leading off, saying, you're good, you're good, you're good, back, 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 back. And then now when that pitcher turns and wheels around to throw to first, I kind of try and collapse that sound all down to in front of you as if you're the runner diving back into first base.
Do you ever use any fake sound, anything that's not actually live there from the game?
Never. Never, ever. That'd be cheating, you know? Baseball's like a really still America's pastime to us, man. We wouldn't really want to cheapen it out with any of that.
That's Joe Carpenter. He's the sound designer behind the World Series on Fox. Joe, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Great speaking with you, too.
That's hammered in the left. Off the bat of Infante. It's gone.
Jim Woodring is a true American original. Some people consider him the most important cartoonist of his generation. You can find his paintings and charcoal drawings in serious art galleries today. Like a lot of people, I fell in love with Woodring's cartoons back in the 90s. A lot of them are drawn in the somewhat abstracted style of the old black-and-white Betty Boop or Mickey Mouse cartoons. But the world they inhabit is so fantastic, surreal, grotesque, and unnerving, it's almost impossible to describe. Woodring bases many of his drawings on nightmarish hallucinations he experiences from time to time. I sat down with Woodring to talk about the visions that have shaped his career and about a new compendium of his earliest work, an autobiographical comic called Jim.
It's comics, it's tone poems, it's charcoal drawings, pen and ink drawings, stories with illustrations. It's just a number of different approaches that I came up with in order to say these disparate but related things that obsessed me.
I want to talk about your artistic vision, because you have visions. You see apparitions.
Well, I did when I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
and I've hallucinated regularly throughout my life, although it's sort of tapered off.
You had a vision in particular that you describe in a junior college class in Glendale.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that was a big one for me. I was taking an art history class, and when the screen went white, I hallucinated a huge green rubbery amphibious creature coming up from the bottom of the screen, and it shocked me so badly that I can still feel it in the soles of my feet and my hands.
You'd had apparitions before, but there was something about this that, that set you on the path that you're on?
Well, it happened at a time when I was actively sort of looking for a sign. I needed direction in my life, and I didn't have a lot of self-confidence. And this frog provided me with the answers to that by way of making me feel that I had within me everything that I needed to go forth and make myself a productive life.
It seems that when you were writing these comics that are in Jim during your maybe earlier developmental stage, that it sounds like you couldn't support yourself with your work. What were the kind of day jobs that you did to get by?
Oh, for one thing, I worked at an advertising agency. And then for most of the 80s, a good friend of mine got me a job at a studio that made animated cartoons for children. And they weren't the kind of animated cartoons that you could take a lot of pride in.
Can you say what they were?
Well, I don't want to badmouth my employers. They were awfully good to me. But the company was called Ruby Spears. And the cartoons that I worked on were things like the Mr. T Show, Rubik the Amazing Cube, which was launched 5 years after the fad was dead.
Hello, my name is Rubik.
I remember those, actually, yeah.
Yeah, well, I worked on the storyboards for those things and other things.
Getting back to the apparitions, do you still see them?
I haven't for a couple of years now, actually. The last one I saw, I came up the stairs of my house to the second floor landing, and I saw a guy standing at the end of the hall wearing a leather harness on his face and grimacing and staring at me. And at first I thought it was my reflection in a mirror until I realized there was no mirror there, and then it lingered long enough for me to scrutinize it. And as I usually do, I drew it. I made a picture of it. And it's a scary image.
And when you're actually seeing it like that, are you frightened, or how does it feel?
It isn't frightening because something in me knows that it's not threatening. I don't know what it is. It's hard to explain how easily I can accept these things, even though they're completely irrational. The one that I had before this, which is about 4 years ago, I looked out my window and I saw Thompson and Thompson from the Hergé stories, the Tintin stories, in black and white, walking down the street behind a 9-foot-tall hooker in red hot pants. And when it resolved into what it was just a woman and her two kids walking down the street. But for about 10 seconds, I saw the aforementioned group in completely lifelike detail. It was as if they were really there.
What do you think that it means that they're happening less? And is that a good thing?
I hope. I've waited all my life to be an old man, and now that I am one, I find it suits me. And I'd hate to think that it's really the beginning of something terrible.
Jim Woodring is a cartoonist and writer. His latest book is a compilation of his earliest comics called Jim. Jim Woodring, love your work, and it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Arun. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about career triumphs, big and small. Tuesday is the NBA's opening night, so who better to talk to than Tyrone Muggsy Bogues? Remember him? He's the 5'3" point guard who was the shortest player in NBA history. Muggsy Bogues was drafted by Washington back in 1987 when they were the Bullets. But he's best known for playing with the Charlotte Hornets alongside Alonzo Mourning and Larry Johnson. Bogues says he comes from a family of five-footers, so when he stopped growing as a kid, it was no surprise.
Five-footers, yeah, actually. But my mom, she was the only one 4'11", you know. But everybody else, we was 5 feet. My sister, 5'1". My dad was 5'7", 5'8", if I give him that. Of course, I'm 5'3", so I always tell people I think my mom had me when I was 5'3". I don't remember ever growing. I was still little Tyrone, and I always got this negative feedback from the game of basketball, telling you, you're wasting your time. What are you doing? You're too small. You'll never play basketball. You know, why were these people saying that? And I know I can play. I didn't get chosen. the guys that decide to pick their teams, you know, the game is being played and we got to sit over and watch, and you get tired of just watching. So I found two milk crates that where we cut the bottom of the milk crates, and we went on the other side and we tied the milk crates on each end of the fence. And we had our own milk crate basketball pickup game, and it was a good time because we could jump off the fence and dunk the basketball. You had to be creative in order to play, and I wanted to play. Very aggressive. I had to play that way because I was small, little kid that just was out there trying to create havoc, just trying to disrupt a lot of things. Then all of a sudden they were like, that little kid can play. Then they start, you know, including me in things, and you start fitting yourself in. All of a sudden, little Muggsy starting to get a little reputation in the neighborhood. When I was in high school, I was just fortunate enough to be on one of the best high schools they say was ever assembled. We was the number one team in the nation. People still didn't believe, well, he played in high school. He had some success in high school, but it's a whole other world when you get to college. No one would give him a major Division I scholarship. And, of course, that was answered. Wake Forest came knocking at the door, and I accepted that offer. And it changed my life completely. Of course, you know, the first year, the commentators, why did they waste a four-year scholarship on a little kid that's only 5'3" who barely could see over a table? And all this negativity started coming from so many directions. And I told my assistant coach, Coach Nesta, at the time, that I'm done.
I wonder what size shoe he wears, about 3.5. They save money on him, though. He sleeps in a drawer of one of the guy's chests.
And we had the chance to play a national televised game against NC State. I had one of the brilliant games. Had 20 points, 10 assists, and from that moment on, I continued to keep building that reputation, and there was some great times back then.
Welcome to the 1987 NBA Draft.
The NBA Draft, 1987. I can't remember. Might have been a Friday night. I tell you, it was a miraculous day.
Let's see what David Stern has.
The Washington Bullets select Tyrone Bowles.
Felt like the whole world was lifted off his shoulders. You know, you felt like I have arrived.
Tyrone Bogues from Wake Forest, 5'3", 140 pounds, 22 years old. He is now the shortest player in the NBA.
All the naysayers, people saying that you're never, why are you even thinking about it? A guy my size wanting to pursue a game that was supposed to be meant for, you know, the big guys. That was a special, special moment. That was my big break. That was my big break.
Retired NBA player Tyrone Muggsy Bogues. These days, he runs his youth outreach group, Always Believe, Inc., in Charlotte. You don't have to be the shortest player in the NBA to have a big break. Send us your story at mybigbreak@npr.org. Through the decades, classical cellists have studied the masters. Casals, Rostropovich, Jacqueline Dupre, Angus Young. All right, so maybe Angus Young doesn't usually make that list. But cellist Maya Beiser loves playing his music. She's giving some of her favorite rock and blues tunes a modern cello workover on her new album, Uncovered. Maya Beiser is here with me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So the first thing I want to ask you while I'm hearing this music in my ears is, how did you get that awesome electric guitar sound out of the cello for Back in Black?
Well, I'm lucky to have a great sound engineer. But, it's really my acoustic cello processed through an electric guitar fuzz box and reamped.
We should say, though, that this is, you are an established, people would call you a classical cellist. I mean, you play a lot of non-traditional repertoire and use that kind of processing that we talked about, but this is still a departure for you.
I guess it is, although, you know, if you look at the trajectory of all the things I've done, this is very much within line because My whole kind of career mission has been to reintroduce new ideas and new sounds for the cello.
You know, I have this feeling, it's something I complain about, is that I feel like classical music in America feels very conservative, that it, sometimes it's hard to hear music that's been written in modern times.
Oh, it does. It does, Arun. It's a big problem.
So have you had resistance in playing the music you play and now playing rock and roll?
Yeah, initially there was this sense of, contemporary music, nobody wants to hear it. But the truth is that it's kind of the reverse these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to make concert music part of the cultural landscape. And it's great to play the great old masters from the past, but in order to really make it a relevant art form, the only way is really to play music that is relevant to our culture.
One of your teachers was the great violinist Isaac Stern, and I understand you had a conversation with him about rock and roll.
I did. You know, he was my first big mentor. I grew up in Israel, and I was discovered by Stern when I was 12. And around a little after that time, I started to listen to rock and roll, and I fell in love with Janis Joplin and with, you know, Brian Eno. And so I did go to Stern and told him about this music, and I was kind of naive little girl, you know, and I thought, you know, this music is so great. I would like to try to do it on the cello. And he looked at me very upset and said, you know, this is really not serious music.
Yeah, tell us about your first experience hearing Janis Joplin. I understand that had a big impact on you.
It did. Well, you know, the first time I heard Janis Joplin, it just shook me to the core. You know, you have to imagine a young accolade of any dogma experiencing her first transgression. And I was, you know, very much, classical music geek. And she just made her way into my inner shrine. And I just vowed right there then that I would play. I wanted to play the cello the way that she sang.
Speaking with cellist Maya Beiser, her new album is a collection of her versions of some classic rock and blues tunes. It's called Uncovered. You know, something we associate with classical music is a certain perfection, like a purity of tone and that kind of thing. And one of the things you seem to embrace in this, I'm thinking of your cover of Lithium, of, Kurt Cobain, that you kind of embrace the imperfections a little bit.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, the idea of embracing the imperfection, because one of the most problematic thing in the whole sort of, you know, Western classical approach is this incredible strive for, you know, you learn for years and years just doing everything in the most perfect way. And I think it takes away from the personality of the performer. And, you know, for me, the performers that I've always loved the most were the ones who were kind of imperfect in a way. Pablo Casals is one good example of that. You know, there was
always...
great cellist. Glenn Gould. There was always this really strong sense of personal voice.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about personal voice, then it's never about perfection. It's about something else. It's about expression. It's about imperfection in some way, you know, and so I think one of the things that I've learned to do is just kind of like to embrace that.
That's Maya Beiser. Her new album is a reimagining of a bunch of great rock and roll and blues songs. It's called Uncovered. Maya Beiser, it's been a blast speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Arun.
Can I get the Austin Blues with onions and sweet peppers?
On 3rd Street in downtown L.A., Stephen Robbins is ordering one of the exotic grilled sausages on the menu at Wurstkuka.
A small fry with the walnut dip and truffle oil.
Walk just a few blocks away, and there's a more modest business on the street.
Me, I sit out here, and you know, I sell my cigarettes. I may sell other things I'm not going to say.
That's Leah. I met her while she was sitting on a milk crate on 5th Street.
Cigarettes is $2.50 a pack out here. So you can get a carton for $25 and sell it for $50. That's double your money.
Leah doesn't want to give her last name because she says it's not safe to do that here on L.A.'s Skid Row. A lot of people want to fix Skid Row, but how it's done is extremely controversial. And as downtown L.A. develops, it's a problem that's become more and more urgent. That's our cover story today. Skid Row is like a different planet from the affluent downtown areas that practically surround it. 50 blocks of sidewalk here are jammed with people who live on the street and their worldly possessions crammed into shopping carts, crates, cardboard boxes. In the hot midday Southern California sun, the place stinks of urine, human excrement, and garbage. Last year, there was a major outbreak of tuberculosis here. Lizette Nelson is crossing the street with her rolling suitcase. She says she's headed to a shelter called Pathways.
If not for them, I guess I'd be sleeping on Skid Row with the rest of these people.
More than 1,000 people sleep on the street in Skid Row, in cardboard boxes and tents, just a mile from City Hall. Leah, she's the woman I met selling cigarettes, says she's seen some changes on the street lately.
Definitely, it's gotten worse on violence. The cops are starting to crack down more, I guess, as they want to clean it up out here, make it a little bit better for people to live, but this is Skid Row. It's always going to be Skid Row.
But a lot of people, including some with very deep pockets, disagree.
Everybody needs to ultimately deal with the fact that downtown is going to continue to develop. There will be development in Skid Row. There will be.
That's developer Tom Gilmore. He was speaking at a panel discussion last month about the future of Skid Row.
Skid Row is not where people are born. It is where they come because of what I think everybody can now agree is at best an outdated notion of segregating, isolating, and concentrating a homeless population and the services associated with them in one area. And I think that because there's a new residential population in downtown, everybody's beginning to understand that it's not the rug you can sweep everything under.
And Gilmore says development doesn't mean reducing services for the homeless. But Gilmore's perspective was offensive to several in the audience who believe development will favor the well-off at the expense of the poorest. Longtime activists say that there is a real danger that development will simply ignore the needs of the thousands living on Skid Row. But new residents and businesses say they want to play a role in improving Skid Row. Blair Beston helped organize the panel discussion.
I'm the executive director of the Historic Core Business Improvement District, and I'm also a resident.
The Business Improvement District collects taxes from local property owners. That money pays for street cleanups and private security patrols. Beston says the homeless on Skid Row used to be easier for the city to ignore, but with more people moving downtown, that's changing.
A sense of shame is really motivating people now to finally address this issue because it's so apparent in the streets everywhere you look.
The lobby of the Union Rescue Mission is packed on a recent morning. They've been working on Skid Row for decades. It feels like a cross between an apartment building and a secure court facility. They have private rooms alongside temporary shelter and dorms for about 800 people. The mission also provides substance abuse counseling and other services. It's a Christian charity, although non-Christians and non-believers are welcome here. Andy Bales runs the mission and has worked on Skid Row for almost 10 years.
What I describe Skid Row as is the biggest man-made disaster in the United States.
Bales said things had been improving on Skid Row, but they've taken a bad turn since the recession. Hospitals from the region and even other states have been dumping homeless patients on Skid Row illegally. He says jails are releasing inmates without enough preparation, and resources have been reduced for shelters in favor of other approaches.
What do you see that's different than it was just a few years ago?
Fear had left Skid Row. That's back. Violence every day. Across the street, there's crack cocaine sales. And by the self-cleaning restroom on the corner down here, they're selling heroin. You know, take that times 49 blocks. That's what Skid Row is. And the answer for this really is decentralizing services.
Andy Bales says ideally people should receive treatment and help in their own communities. But he says it can be difficult to convince neighborhoods to accept new homeless shelters, affordable housing, or treatment facilities.
Do you have any fear that there could be a situation where this neighborhood is transformed, it's gentrified or whatever word you want to use, but the people that were here are still, wherever they end up, not getting the services they need?
I do have a fear of that because we are often market-driven instead of compassion-driven. Of course, we need it. We need investors. We need all of that. But we need compassionate people who care about the people who are potentially displaced, and we need to make sure there's a place for them to go, and that place is not just on the sidewalk or a bush in another neighborhood.
Shelters like the Union Rescue Mission continue to fill up with people in need. But recently, another place opened up for some of L.A.'s chronically homeless, the Star Apartments on Skid Row. The building is beautiful, modern, and bright. There are more than 100 apartments where the homeless can stay permanently, turn their lives around, and get easy access to a health clinic and other services on site. NPR's Tom Dreisbach went to the grand opening and has the story.
It's my great pleasure to honor you to the grand opening of the Star Apartments today. And today is a great day.
That's Mike Alvidrez. He runs the nonprofit Skid Row Housing Trust. And on this sunny morning in L.A., he officially unveiled its latest project. But away from the speeches, sitting on a second-floor patio, I met Jude Burns eating breakfast. Burns is 44 years old, but there was a cane at his side. He says it helps him walk through his pain.
Sometimes it's so bad, man, I can't even get out of bed. But then I have good days and bad days, you know, so today's one of the good days.
Burns now lives at the Star Apartments. He moved in about a year ago. He and the other residents were allowed to settle in before the big grand opening. But he didn't always need this type of help. Burns moved to L.A. a few years back to be closer to his 14-year-old son. He had been diagnosed with diabetes, but he says he had it under control. Then, on New Year's Eve 2011, his son was shot and killed in South L.A., an apparently random murder. Jude Burns went into a deep depression.
After my son's death, my health just started going completely downhill.
The diabetes got worse. He got pancreatitis. Then came the complications. He needed two surgeries. For a while, he bounced around between friends' couches and hospitals.
So I would say I was at the emergency room at least once every 2 months.
After all, he wasn't making regular doctor's appointments to deal with his health problems. Instead, he went to the closest ER and waited 8, 9, 10 hours at a time.
Actually, I've probably been in every hospital in California, if you ask me. You know, I've been in a lot of emergency rooms.
After one of his surgeries, his luck changed. A hospital social worker linked Burns up with temporary housing through LAMP Community on Skid Row. They told him about the Star Apartments.
And now I got my own place, handle my own keys. I'm happy about that. Thankful.
Burns says it was the first time in 3 years he had his own stove, his own refrigerator, his own bathroom. And most importantly, now Burns doesn't have to drag himself to the ER to see a doctor or a social worker.
They're also going to have clinics and doctors and stuff. They're downstairs, you know, everything is right here.
There are caseworkers on site downstairs alongside a health clinic that's opening with staff doctors and nurses. This model of ending homelessness is called permanent supportive housing. The idea is that the best way to improve the homelessness situation and to handle all the chronic health and mental health problems is to get people housed first, then work on the other issues that can seem extremely challenging.
In fact, many people would consider the folks that we're housing
unhousable. They're too sick, they're too disruptive, they're too drug addicted. And our philosophy is to just flip that around.
That's Mark Trotz. He runs L.A. County's two-year-old Housing for Health program. They're helping to run the Star Apartments and have actually moved staff inside the building.
We know that a home doesn't miraculously cure mental illness or long-term substance abuse issues, but we know you can't. It's almost impossible to get to those issues when someone is homeless.
Trotz calls Skid Row a health disaster zone.
We're stuck in this cycle that we see where this population basically revolves from the street to the hospital, to the jails, back to the street, maybe to shelter, maybe to treatment, and can do that for 5, 10, 15 years and just steadily decline in health and die, essentially.
Trotz and the county want to break that cycle by creating buildings like the Star Apartments throughout L.A. County. According to Trotz, they have created 700 units in the county with a goal of 10,000 by 2018. Dennis Culhane is a professor of social policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He says experience has shown that permanent supportive housing works.
The research is very robust. It shows that about 85% of the people who are placed in this housing remain there 1 year later. Even among the people who exit, many of them are exiting to other planned arrangements. Only a few percentage is actually returning to homelessness.
Culhane says these programs frequently save government money, too, by reducing ER visits and time in jail. Some worry that the focus on permanent supportive housing for the sickest and most desperate will shortchange emergency services for the majority of the homeless. And at its current rate, the county is well behind schedule on meeting its goal of creating 10,000 units of permanent supportive housing. But Jude Burns has a word for his one unit at the Star Apartments. A blessing. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
Earlier this month, four men and four women set up camp on Mauna Loa in Hawaii, treating the rocky slope of the volcano as if it were the surface of Mars. They live inside a dome, and if they want to go outside, they have to put on bulky spacesuits. It's the third round of NASA's High Seas experiment.
They are basically test subjects where they fill out surveys, collect data, run their own personal experiments, and these are all used to kind of think of the way that we need to design a mission to Mars.
That's Kate Green, one of those test subjects in the first round of the mission. Based in part on her time in the dome, she got to wondering, why aren't more astronauts women? She explored those thoughts in a piece on Slate.com and tells me it's actually not a new idea.
There are a lot of female pilots in the late 50s and early 60s who were interested in becoming America's first astronauts. And there were tests that were run, and there's a whole campaign behind it. But in the end, NASA went with the test pilots, the military test pilots that are so famous that we know of today.
What were the reasons that they thought that women might do better at being astronauts?
Oh, there are a number of reasons. So some of the medical tests show that women had stronger hearts that could withstand changes in acceleration. And there are some isolation studies that showed that fewer women had hallucinations over a period of time as opposed to men. And then there is the more important thing. So women are smaller. They eat less food. They require fewer calories. And if you need to send up less food on a mission, you don't need to have as large a payload. You don't need to use as much rocket fuel. And you can save a huge amount of money.
Now, when you were on this high seas mission simulating living on Mars, you got to observe up close the advantage women had over the men.
Right. And that's what got me thinking about it in the first place. So I was looking at the data one day, and, you know, this is all anonymous data, but I could see the sex of each subject. And I saw this trend that on average, women were expending half the calories of the men on the crew. I just saw this again and again, week in and week out. And, you know, I also saw it sitting at the dinner table, who took seconds and who filled up their plate. It's kind of obvious, but it was nice to have the data to show that.
And talk about why this is important for a space mission.
Well, when you think about a Mars mission, that's, I mean, you're going to be in space for 2.5 years, roughly. I mean, the idea is for a round-trip mission that you're just going to load, the payload is going to include all the food for the entire mission. That's a lot of food. When we got to our 4-month high seas mission, we had to inventory 4 months of food, and I had never seen so much food in my life. I had never seen so much peanut butter. I had never seen so much Nutella. And this is the sort of thing that would launch on a mission to Mars. And if you can cut that payload in half, you're going to save some rocket fuel and you're going to save costs.
Is there any chance for getting this proposal to get some traction, to have an all-female crew for a Mars mission?
Well, it's a great question, and I love that it's being talked about as it is. So many of us have this idea of what a space mission would look like to another planet or to an asteroid, and it's a crew of mostly men and maybe a woman, you know, because that's what Hollywood tells us these missions look like. It's fantastic to just turn it upside down and conceive of an all-female crew, and what would that actually be like? And if it saves money, then maybe it should be worth discussing.
That's Kate Green, a participant in the first high seas mission. Her newest article about women astronauts can be found on Slate.com. Kate, thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Everyone who knows rock and roll knows this opening riff. Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. But play it side by side with this other song. And it sounds almost the same, except this song, Taurus, came out 3 years before Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. That was more than four decades ago, but just this week, a judge moved forward with a lawsuit against the members of Led Zeppelin and their music publishers. Taurus was written by Randy California, founding member of the band Spirit. He died in 1997, but his heirs want compensation for plagiarism and a songwriting credit. I turn to Eric Gardner of The Hollywood Reporter to explain.
The judge will basically hear both songs. Both sides will bring forth musicologists, and they'll debate whether the songs are really similar.
But this judge could have no musical knowledge at all, right?
Yes, and that adds the wild card factor to this, because no one knows what a judge in Pennsylvania is going to say. I mean, Pennsylvania, there's very few cases that have examined copyright infringement in song craft.
Why is it in Pennsylvania, though?
The only thing that I can really think of is that the lawyer for the plaintiffs is based in Pennsylvania. If the plaintiffs wanted to have a tactical advantage, they probably would have sued in Nashville, the songwriter capital of the world. And if they wanted this to be convenient for the parties, they would have sued in California, where a lot of the plaintiffs and witnesses are, and as well as a lot of the music defendants.
Why is it going through now, 43 years after Stairway to Heaven was released?
Time goes on. Randy California dies. His heirs start thinking that they might have a claim. Rock historians have suspected that at least the opening notes to Stairway to Heaven were lifted from the song Taurus, and a lawyer comes forward and willing to work on contingency, and voila, a lawsuit.
Now, this is not the first time that Led Zeppelin has been accused of lifting songs. I mean, can you tell us about some of their checkered history with this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of their biggest songs, A Whole Lot of Love and Dazed and Confused, those have been brought up in court before.
Let's hear the original Dazed and Confused by American folk singer Jake Holmes.
I'm dazed and confused. Is it stay, is it go? Am I being choosed? Well, I'd just like to know.
And here, of course, is Led Zeppelin.
Been dazed and confused for so long, it's not true. Wanted a woman, never bargained for you.
Unlike the song, the Spirit song in Stairway to Heaven, this one, that's the same song.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's fairly unmistakable. And you know, one of the things that courts consider is just what do regular people, what are they going to think about the two songs? Do they hear similarities?
Finally, in the interest of stirring up some more controversy, here's another track recorded in 1975, a song called We Used To.
We used to walk through fields of green.
So Eric, do you think that Led Zeppelin or Spirit have grounds to sue Dolly Parton?
Yeah, well, this sort of thing happens a lot in music. I mean, there's only so many notes in the music vocabulary. That being said, you know, it's unmistakable. You can hear the similarities. There is also a concept known as transformative use. Mm-hmm. One person might do something, and another person might take what's already been made and make it different or make it better or make it a commentary on what came before. So, you know, fair use plays a good part in this discussion as well.
Eric Gardner from The Hollywood Reporter. Eric, really interesting stuff. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
In 1995, Jean-Dominique Bauby, editor of the French Elle magazine, suffered a massive stroke. He was left in a state known as locked-in syndrome, paralyzed physically, but mentally aware. He was only able to move his left eyelid and used it to dictate his memoir, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. Now we turn to a story about a patient who was left in a similar state, but learned to communicate with brain waves. In 2009, Barry Beck, a geologist in his 60s, had a series of strokes. They caused extensive damage to his right occipital lobe and to the brainstem.
According to the neurologist and the MRI scans, he had one of the worst cases of locked-in syndrome that they had seen.
That's Eric Sellers, a professor at East Tennessee State University. He and his team started working with Beck 10 months after his stroke.
When I first saw him, he had a little bit of eye movement, and that was really the only way that he could communicate.
Beck's wife contacted Sellers when she heard about the research he was doing. Sellers runs the Brain-Computer Interface Laboratory, where he focuses on helping people with severe motor disabilities to communicate. He and his team were working on a system to connect brain waves and computers to make a virtual keyboard.
It's basically, instead of using your hands to press keys on the keyboard, you're using brain waves to press the keys.
To use the system, you would wear a non-invasive electrode cap and sit in front of a monitor that has a picture of a keyboard. At random, groups of letters flash.
And if you want to choose the A, you pay attention to the A, and then every time the A flashes, your brain produces this response. It's called a P300. And this P300 is like an aha response. So your brain kind of says, aha, that's the one I want to select.
The technology has been used to help people with Lou Gehrig's disease compose messages. It's also allowed people to control wheelchairs and prosthetic limbs just by thinking. But Barry Beck was one of the first patients with a severe brainstem injury to use it successfully. Eric Sellers and his team started slow, with just four letters, Y for yes, N for no, P for pass, and E for end.
The first major interaction we had was a 25-question dialogue that ended up in us determining that he wanted more information regarding his prognosis.
Once they knew he was able to use it, they fine-tuned the settings and eventually presented him with a full alphabet so he could spell out words. Barry Beck could now communicate.
One of the first messages that he spelled was to his wife. He spelled out, thank you for all of your hard work. He, on a couple of occasions, also asked me to make the system go faster. And I of course, told him that I was trying. I'm doing my best.
That's because the system is slow, very slow. It took Beck 38 seconds to select each character. Much of Sellers' research now is focused on making the machine faster and more accurate. But for Beck, the painstaking task was worth it.
It was also something that gave his wife a lot of satisfaction, knowing that he was actually, you know, still in there and for the most part cognitively intact. His kids would visit while he used the BCI. And so it had a really large effect on the family as well.
Sellers and his team worked with Beck for more than a year, conducting therapy sessions in the nursing home where he lived. In November of 2011, at the age of 67, Barry Beck died. But Sellers says that through his participation, Barry Beck played a part in making this technology more accessible to other locked-in patients.
For the people that are participating in our research program, they understand that they may not benefit from this technology, but they also realize how important it could be for people who are in similar situations.
Sellers imagines a future where this technology is available in hospitals.
If someone has some type of injury, an automobile accident or something like that, and they have to be intubated and on a respirator, you could imagine that emergency rooms, trauma wards, would actually have these.
Eric Sellers has documented his work with Barry Beck in a research paper published earlier this month in the journal Science Translational Medicine. Rolling Stone called it the greatest album of all time. And for some, that's an understatement. The Beatles released Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in 1967, raising the standard of rock and roll and challenging their peers to catch up. For just about anyone who cares about rock music, this album is unassailable. You cannot top the Beatles' versions of these songs. And yet... Flaming Lips are about to release a song-by-song re-recording of the entire album. The Lips have developed their own proud tradition of layered psychedelic sounds and studio wizardry, but obviously they recognize they're treading on hallowed ground here. I asked bandleader Wayne Coyne, why?
I mean, there's lots and lots and lots of music out there that is in that realm of, like, it's, you know, it's masterpiece and it's, you know, it's in the realm of the gods. But for people that, you know, that make music and record music, you almost have to get in there and go, how did they do this? And so that thing of it being like this untouchable thing, you know, it to us, it's just the opposite. It's like the better it is, the more you want to touch it.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song.
Leaving aside the sacred cow status of Sgt. Pepper, I think one of the challenges would be it's a very idiosyncratic album. How do you approach something like Within You, Without You, or for the benefit of Mr. Kite, and something that's kind of weird to begin with?
Well, see, I think this album, probably more than the others, there's, you know, there's very much some songs that are Paul McCartney songs, and there's very much some songs that are John Lennon songs. You sort of stand away from a Paul McCartney song because you know he's such a great songwriter. These little emotional nuances and mm-hmm. his chord changes and even the range of his singing he's Paul McCartney. I mean, it's intimidating. But what happens with John Lennon, he makes it sort of seem like, this is no big deal. Anybody can do this. You know, it's rock and roll. Just do it, you know. So you always approach his songs like, yeah, he's the dude. He's just going to be doing this off the cuff. And his are even more complicated. And he does all these just weird little time changes that you can't even explain.
Where's an example of that on this album?
Well, I would say the Good Morning song. Mm-hmm. That one is... I mean, when you're driving around in your car listening to it, you can easily skip over what's like a little quarter note, and it doesn't matter because the Beatles are playing and you're not. You know, when you go to play it, these little things are like, oh my God, what are they doing there? It seems so effortless. It seems so simple, and it ain't.
You've got a bunch of guests on this album. I think you're probably getting the most attention, obviously, for working with Miley Cyrus, and she's on this track.
Can you turn Wayne up a little bit?
Picture yourself in a boat on the river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies.
Now, before you were working together, I don't think there'd probably be a very large number of people who have been to both a Flaming Lips show and a Miley Cyrus show. How did you meet?
Well, we had known for a little while that she was a fan of the Flaming Lips, and we probably still called her Hannah Montana back then, you know. Last January 13th, which is my birthday, she did a tweet that said, "Happy birthday, Wayne, you're one of my favorite artists of all time." And when someone of the status of a Miley Cyrus on Twitter says that, about 100 people will text me and say, "Wayne, did you know that Miley Cyrus is wishing you a happy birthday?" And I started to get to know Miley Cyrus. She came to Oklahoma. And
you live in Oklahoma.
I live in Oklahoma, Oklahoma City, yeah. And we sort of organized that we would go to a studio there. It's actually by a studio by the group Hanson, who's kind of, you know, it's funny that Miley Cyrus and the Flaming Lips are recording in Hanson Studio, people who know that group. And we didn't have an idea of doing Sgt. Pepper's, but we had the Lucy in the Sky track. So we asked her, "Hey, let's try this." And her take on it, you know, her vibe or whatever she, you know, you want to say, whatever she brought to it, it was just a great, simple surprise.
Suddenly someone is there at the turnstile, the girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
So I think after that, we thought, let's just put this out. And then I think there was an element of just more logical, reasonable people around us suggested, well, why don't you just try to do the whole record? Wouldn't that be great?
I read the news today,
that's Wayne Coyne. He's the singer and founding member of Flaming Lips. Their song-for-song cover of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band comes out on Tuesday. It's called With a Little Help from My Friends. Until then, you can check out every track at our exclusive First Listen. That's at nprmusic.org. Wayne, it's been really fun speaking with you. Thank you.
Thanks a bunch for having me. You guys are great.
For the week ending October 26, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, Becky Sullivan, Denise Guerra, and Eliza Mills. Our intern is Chloe Prisinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Leo Delagula and Marcia Caldwell. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening. But I just have to know.